a national security threat that fits in your pocket. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Did a Chinese spy just try to infiltrate President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort carrying malware on a thumb drive?
The best attacks from foreign intelligence services are the simplest.
Seriously, though, a thumb drive? Also, WhatsApp gets mixed reviews in India after unveiling a new program to combat fake news there.
They're criticizing that it's a very feeble attempt to fight fake news. And the amount of fake news which is already in circulation is quite enormous.
Plus, waking up to a new reality in Algeria.
I had to pinch myself this morning to realize that this is true.
Weeks of street protests have toppled Algeria's longtime ruler, plus Shell Oil standing up for the climate. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could make it today. How easy is it to hack Mar-a-Lago? Security experts have been saying for a while now that President Trump's Florida beach resort is vulnerable to all sorts of cyber intrusions. And then this weekend, a Chinese national convinced security at Mar-a-Lago to let her in. Yu Jingzhong was carrying a thumb drive infected with malware, several cell phones, a laptop, and two Chinese passports. All of that was suspicious. She was detained, and now she's in Secret Service custody, awaiting a hearing next week. Bob Anderson is CEO of the Texas-based company Cyber Defense Labs. Before that, he led an FBI unit that ran criminal and cyber investigations around the globe. Help us understand, can you hack or infect a computer through a thumb drive? Like, what was this woman allegedly trying to do, from what we know?
No, absolutely you can. I mean, one of the best attacks from foreign intelligence services are the simplest. A lot of the stuff you see on television that looks really extravagant really doesn't work. And I think most of the time, they start with the easiest, most simple attacks, like leaving a thumb drive that somebody may inadvertently put into a computer, which the malware can then automatically launch.
This has happened before, hasn't it?
Oh, it's happened many times, not necessarily to a president's residence or where he spends time, but there's been numerous attacks over the years that different nation-state actors have launched, several against the Department of Defense, other agencies inside the United States government, where they were actually able to insert malware devices, either thumb drives or remote devices, inside of systems that are traditionally what we call air-gapped, and that prevents people from getting into them from the outside internet, but it's very effective if you have somebody on the inside.
So this is obviously the worst-case scenario. We don't know a lot about this case involving the woman going into Mar-a-Lago briefly. What do we know, though? Is this an actual spy?
Well, a couple of things that I've read and I've heard on television really point to this individual possibly being run by some intelligence organization. The fact that she had four cell phones, multiple computers and thumb drives, and then alluding to a, quote, uncle back in China tasking her to come over. Those things would lead me to believe, just from my experience on the national security side, that this probably has bigger implications.
Let's be clear again, though. We don't know if this woman is a spy. Would you be surprised to find out if some state or non-state actor was trying to get to Trump through one of his private properties?
Absolutely not. I mean, that's what they do. Their whole job when it comes to foreign intelligence or clandestine operations, and this is any country that is looking to gain intelligence on the United States, is to try whatever they can to get access to power. And obviously, the President of the United States is at the top of that pyramid. I mean, at least somebody on the staff had enough common sense to really question her hard to the fact where they understood that she should not be there. But she never should have gotten in the first place. And I think there's going to need to be a review of the security procedures around that compound.
Yeah, what would you recommend in terms of kind of making things better?
Well, I think there needs to be kind of a segmentation off of where people would have access to areas the president may go versus traditional club members. And, you know, there's a lot of need to know information that that's exactly what it means. Just because people have the available clearance in these positions to potentially hear information, that doesn't mean that they need to hear it. And I think that needs to cascade down throughout the entire White House and staff. And one of the things that's glaring is how open the president has been over the last several years about talking to a variety of people and also his travel schedule. And I think that's one of the things they really need to look at.
And when you talk about a variety of people, I assume you mean everybody from Vladimir Putin on down to anybody who visits the White House.
Well, anybody that visits the White House or anybody that's visiting people that are very close to the president, and look, let's say no mistake about it, Vladimir Putin was a former colonel in the KGB, one of the most ruthless organizations in the world, and it was disbanded shortly after he retired, went into politics, and then became their sitting president. So when our president or members of his staff that are not savvy with counterintelligence or counterespionage techniques, it's pretty easy for them to try to infiltrate different areas. And I think that's one of the biggest things they need to look at.
Bob Anderson with the Texas-based Cyber Defense Labs, formerly with the FBI. Thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Speaking of hacking generally, India's national elections start next week. It'll be a huge test for social media companies that have been promising to clean up disinformation and propaganda. In India, focus is on the messaging platform WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook. The company announced this week it's creating a fake news tip line in India to help people figure out what information they can trust. Think an interactive version of Snopes. Rema Rajeshwari is a police chief in the southern Indian state of Telangana. She was with us on The World last July when she told us about a unique program she created to combat fake news in her district. Rema, I want to get your initial reaction to this tip line that WhatsApp announced this week. What can you tell us about it?
WhatsApp has been at the center of controversy in India since last year after fake messages spread on its platform sparked a number of lynching incidents. Over 40 people died, and the company made it harder to forward messages and limited the number of groups to which the messages can be forwarded after it came under a lot of pressure from the government and different stakeholders. 2 days ago, the company came up with this new initiative called Checkpoint Tip Line. This, as they say, is to stop the spread of suspect viral content ahead of India's national elections. And by launching this tip line, they are saying that they're able to enable the users to point up dubious information for debunking. For this, they have partnered with an Indian startup called Proto to create a system in which users can forward suspicious messages they have received.
So it's a collaboration. A lot of organizations and people seem concerned about the fake news there.
Well, yeah, very much. So even this one, some are not quite happy about this step because they're criticizing that it's a very feeble attempt to fight fake news. And it's too little and too late because we barely have 10 days to go for the national elections. And the amount of fake news, which is already in circulation, is quite enormous. We just have to wait and see in the next 10 days how fast they can get to the job.
I'm curious, Rema, have you tried using Checkpoint Tip Line? And what does it actually do? How does it work?
Well, you know, you have to send a message first. They have given this number. So you send a message to them and the response typically comes instantly by saying that, thank you, we have received your information. We will verify the content and get back to you. And they also have similar responses in 4 Indian languages, in Hindi, in Bengali, in Malayalam, and Telugu. But the ones who have been using the service since last 24 hours have been complaining that it's not instant. For that, the company came up with a response saying that if it's a known rumor, the user will get a quick response. But if it's a new one, a new rumor, it will take some time for the verification center to determine if it can be verified.
What kind of fake news stories are you seeing in your district?
Well, WhatsApp is still rife with misleading content with regard to the candidates, with regard to the manifesto of certain political parties, and about the recent attack in the state of Kashmir. There was a terror attack a month ago. So post that terror attack, there was a huge volume of misinformation being spread. So if you look at the type of messages being spread these days, it's something to do with religion and to do with the candidates, their characters, about their assets, and the authenticity and the credibility of a particular candidate. Let's just see. But for now, this is the kind of messages we are seeing in the platform in India.
Rema Rajeshwari is a police chief in the southern Indian state of Telangana, where she oversees about 700 villages. Rema, all the best and have a lovely evening.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Vice
President Mike Pence sent a stark warning to Turkey today.
Turkey's purchase of a $2.5 billion S-400 anti-aircraft missile system from Russia poses great danger to NATO and to the strength of this alliance.
That Russian anti-aircraft system is meant to find and shoot down enemy planes. The problem is the U.S. military was planning to deliver two of its new high-tech fighter jets to Turkey in June. That was the plan. The other thing Pence said today, Turkey must choose. And the choice is between its NATO allies and its deepening connection to Russia. Aaron Mehta is Pentagon correspondent for Defense News. He says there are a couple of reasons why it is a big deal that Turkey is buying a Russian air defense system.
The first is that the S-400, its Russian system, is kind of the linchpin of Russia's air defense efforts. So the idea of integrating an air defense system that's built by Russia, full of Russian software that gathers information for Russia, and plugging that into, say, an American-made jet that would be its main competitor in case war breaks out, has got a lot of people in the NATO alliance feeling a little itchy, to put it lightly. The other aspect here is plugging it into NATO systems generally, not just the F-35, but NATO's own air defense plans. Again, these systems are all wired. You know, the idea of a military system that just sits by itself and launches things, that's out the window. Everything's electronic. Everything's gathering data constantly, shipping that data to a central location, and people are crunching that data. The NATO alliance looks at this and says, hey, we don't want Russia sitting here in Turkey, in the middle of the alliance, gathering information on everything that we're doing, hooking up into our systems and picking them apart. We can't have that happen.
So if Turkey knows this is a big deal, buying a Russian air defense system, and that this is going to antagonize NATO allies, why do it? Why play both sides?
That's really the big question. And the answer seems to be it goes back to President Erdogan, Turkey's president, who has clashed a bit in the last few years with Western nations over some of the internal politics of his country. Particularly, you can look at the 2016 military coup attempt against him, which led to a big crackdown on freedoms inside Turkey. The West, particularly under President Obama and other Western leaders, pushed back against that fairly hard. There's a very interesting event today where Turkey's foreign minister was speaking at a event that's supposed to be for NATO's 70th birthday. And he kind of came in and laid down his viewpoint, which was, we don't have to choose between Russia and the West. There's no benefit to us to only be aligned with the West or only to be aligned for the Russians. We're going to do both. We're going to play both sides. It's going to end up benefiting us in the long term.
So the U.S. is retaliating against Turkey by suspending delivery of these F-35 warplanes. But is the Trump administration in lockstep with the Pentagon decision?
This is a big question. We'd assumed until really this morning that they were. This was a whole government thing. But again, the Turkish foreign minister today essentially said, hey, we're getting mixed signals from America on this. The Pentagon's saying one thing, but others are saying something else. When pushed on that others, he said there's a recent phone call between Trump and Erdogan. And in that discussion, Trump promised that he would, quote, take care of this issue. So is it possible that they're giving different statements privately? It's entirely possible. We're going to just have to see how this plays out.
Aaron, at this point, is anyone questioning Turkey's NATO membership? And can the U.S. afford to lose Turkey as an ally?
Geopolitically, that would be a bad sign, right? That's a big win for Russia. If the alliance was to say, Turkey, get out, you're no longer a member, they would be the first member to be kicked out of the alliance in its history. The second is logistical. Turkey not only is a major ally, they're a major hub, particularly for American military power.
Right.
I think the status quo that we're starting to see emerge is essentially Turkey will remain a NATO ally, but kind of be seen as not fully trusted. How that's going to work going forward for an alliance that's built on being able to trust each other is going to be interesting to see.
Aaron Mehta, Pentagon correspondent for Defense News. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, New Orleans, Italian Americans, and an apology that's taken more than 100 years to happen. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Paying for internet access can be expensive anywhere. That's certainly the case in rural South Africa. But there's an experimental program that aims to make cheap Wi-Fi a reality for residents there, and it could be a model for other countries to follow. My BBC colleague Vaudi Carlis sent this report from the village of Mankosi in South Africa.
Mama, I'm wondering if I could buy a voucher.
Yes, you can.
The first person we meet is Nonsokolo Sikau, a shopkeeper. She's one of a handful who sell vouchers that gives residents and visitors uncapped Wi-Fi for under $2 a month.
So did you know what Wi-Fi was before it came?
No, we didn't know. It came and connected. Then we see.
7 years ago, researchers from the University of the Western Cape, with the help of the community, built a mesh network here, a cheap, low-energy system using scattered node devices rather than a central mast used by traditional telecoms networks.
We're at the home of one of the headmen of the villages that make up Mankosi, and once a month, community members meet here as part of the cooperative.
The cooperative collects the money made from selling Wi-Fi vouchers. This is then funneled into community projects and upkeep of the network. The name of it is Enzeleni. It means do-it-yourself. And 33-year-old Zukucheche is the embodiment of that slogan. Previously unemployed and unskilled, he's now the resident technician.
At the beginning, I thought it's impossible, you know. And then as time goes, I saw, no, this is going to be real. That's why I put in my effort, trying to learn everything.
One of the biggest barriers is access to devices that support the network. At the local school, students make use of smartphones.
Yeah, it's not the internet app. So it's just
grade 9 student, Novula Nyati.
The internet has helped us here. We've been able to learn how we can use it for research, and I think it's important for our village development.
Community networks like this one could be a way to connect Africa to the global village. The people of Mankosi say this is just the start.
The BBC's Voldy Carlis reporting from Mankosi, South Africa. Next week, New Orleans Mayor LaToya Cantrell is planning to issue an official apology for a lynching that happened back in 1891. The victims were 11 Italian immigrants. They'd been accused of murdering the city's police commissioner. Before we get into the details of the case, it's important to understand that in the late 1800s, immigrant workers were in high demand in New Orleans.
Slaves had been emancipated a few dozen years before that, so there was a great need for workers. And that was filled by immigrant Sicilians.
That's Michael Santo with the Order of Sons and Daughters of Italy, the group that pushed for that apology from the city of New Orleans. Back in 1891, as I mentioned, Italian workers were blamed for the murder of the city's top police officer. As Michael Santo tells it, Commissioner David Hennessy was gunned down in the middle of the night on his way home.
There is one person who claims that in his dying hours, the police commissioner whispered into his ear that the Dagos did it, of course, referring to Italian Americans. That was the derogatory remark that was passed along.
Santo says that dubious bit of hearsay set events in motion, leading to the lynching of 11 innocent men.
Hundreds of Italians were rounded up and arrested and placed in jail. And ultimately, 19 were charged with the killing of Chief Hennessy. There really was never a case against them. It was all a farce. And what happened was that a lot of the people were upset in the city. And a lot of the people, I mean, folks who were part of the political fabric of that city. And they decided to take out an ad where they asked people to show up the next morning. And thousands of people showed up right to the prison. Their objective was simple. They were going to kill all of these people charged with murder. They tried to break into the prison. They couldn't break in from one location. They went around to another side entrance, and they did eventually get inside. And by that time, the sheriff and the prison warden had released the Italian immigrant inmates and told them to hide. But it was too late. Some were dragged out into the streets and hanged on a lamppost, went on a tree, and they died then. And even despite the fact that they were dead, people were still shooting at the dead bodies.
So here we are, Michael, in 2019. Why this apology now for something that took place in March of 1891?
Because we sat on our ass and waited too long to ask for it. It took a long time. It's 128 years. And finally, our group, called the Commission for Social Justice, which is the anti-defamation arm of the Order of Sons and Daughters of Italy in America, we decided that even at this late date, the terrific wound that still existed in the Italian communities around the nation, and specifically those in New Orleans, still needed to be addressed. The fabric was still destroyed. This story was told from one generation to the other. The Italian groups in New Orleans knew about this, but I think they were hesitant to do anything about it because the descendants of the people on the bad side of this equation, they're still around. They're still running the city. And, you know, why rock the boat? You know, the time heals.
Yeah, so what kind of effort did it take to get this, well, forthcoming apology? Was it a hard fight? I mean, you suggest a lot of people sat on their butts, but I mean, what challenges did you face?
No, we collectively, the Italian-American groups, and collectively the groups that dealt with this bias incident, it's embarrassing, but we waited too long. But when we did approach this administration, they embraced the idea. So no, it was very easy because this particular mayor is the right person at the right time. She is a terrific woman.
You're referring to Mayor LaToya Cantrell, yeah?
Yeah, the mayor assigned the liaison who was terrific from that point forward. And we just went back and forth over the language of the official proclamation of apology. It's a big deal.
Michael, the lynching that you described is believed to be the largest recorded lynching in U.S. history. The key word there, though, being recorded. There were many more lynchings against African Americans. Most of those lynchings were not recorded. Is that something that crossed your mind as you were advocating for this apology?
Yeah, it sure did, because when I hear the word lynching and the way I've been brought up, I always associate it with African Americans in this country and the terrible history that we have with that. I think the second group that was at the wrong end of the lynching issue or the indigenous peoples, American Indians, a lot of them were lynched as well.
There were others. So I'm just wondering how you reconcile this apology with other lynchings that are still open wounds.
Well, I'm hoping that everyone deserves an apology. But I don't think you're going to get an apology from the Ku Klux Klan. I don't think you're going to get an apology from singular families or people who just had this hatred in their heart and who did this on their own or even through small towns. And frankly, everyone deserves an apology to that end.
So on April 12th, 120 years later, you'll be there in New Orleans along with Mayor LaToya Cantrell, who will issue this formal apology. What will that mean to you personally?
It's going to be somewhat of a closure of this wound that has existed. And I think that's important for the local Italian group. I think it's important for the city as a society in terms of how it treats everyone else.
Michael Santo, the special counsel to the Order of Sons and Daughters of Italy. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, one day after Algeria's president Abdelaziz Bouteflika was forced to resign, Algerians are already rewriting his legacy.
He destroyed the country. This is what he will be remembered for.
Plus, we meet the Mexican scientist who's worked for over 20 years to save vaquita porpoises from extinction. The story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. This is what people power sounds like in Algeria, at least for now. Algerians spent most of last night in the streets of Algiers and cities across the country to celebrate the resignation of their longtime president. Abdelaziz Bouteflika stepped down after weeks of mass protests. Algerians watched the state TV channel, many in disbelief, as Bouteflika handed in his resignation letter to the Constitutional Council Tuesday. Farah Swames is a filmmaker in Algeria. She's been part of the protests against Bouteflika's 20-year rule. We just heard the honking and cheering from last night. What does it feel like in Algiers today, one day after Bouteflika's resignation?
It is a pretty weird feeling. I mean, I haven't known any other president beside him in 20 years. I feel very weird. I had to pinch myself this morning to realize that this is true. Maybe for international audiences, it might sound very idealistic or anything, but it means a lot to people. I mean, just think about it. On March 3rd, it was exactly a month ago, he submitted his candidacy to seek re-election. And a month later, he's resigning after mass protests.
What went through your mind when you heard yesterday that Bouteflika had actually resigned?
A couple of hours before, there was a reunion at the army, and the army spoke to the people, and they said that they are going to apply Article 102, you know, that says that the president is unfit to rule the country. So we were expecting somehow that we will have a big announcement, but him resigning was a big news, to be honest.
So that's why there's concern that this was not actually just people power, this might have actually been a coup d'etat.
People are saying it was a military coup, etc. But you cannot discredit the efforts of people. They kept the pressure. They kept protesting for 6 weeks in a row. And they are still going to protest on Friday.
It is for sure the end of the Bouteflika chapter in Algeria's history. What would you say is Bouteflika's legacy? What will he be remembered for in Algeria?
He destroyed the country. This is what he will be remembered for. I don't know if you are aware, but now, right now on the Algerian Twitter, people are posting, you know, his bad legacy, what he did. He divided an entire country. He went into very foolish projects. But most of all, people are going to remember forever his selfish side. He wanted to cling in power for so long. He wanted to die as president.
Well, he, in the end, did not want to leave the office of the president. But in the beginning, wasn't it on Bouteflika's watch that the bloody civil war in Algeria ended in the early 90s? And a lot of people...
Well, people give him credit for this. But this is not the reality. The reality is much more complex than that. But he came and he used it as a legacy when he came back. Okay, I got, you know, a country that was in the midst of a very horrific civil war and I fixed things. This is not what's happening.
We're speaking with Farah Swames, a filmmaker in Algiers, about the resignation of President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. So what about the future? What are your concerns about this transition?
It's maybe the hardest question you can ask any Algerian right now. Things are escalating very quickly. What I can tell you is that the tougher part is coming.
Describe that tougher part. I mean, what are your concerns about who's going to lead the country and the military?
We don't have leading opposition figures. People lost trust in the opposition years ago. So even people are like, okay, let's remove them all. And what to do next?
When you say remove them all, who are you talking about?
Yeah, well, this was the slogan in Arabic since day one of the protests. Remove them all. It means Bouteflika and everybody who is surrounding him, his entire administration.
I mean, the truth is democracy has not arrived in Algeria simply with the resignation of Bouteflika. It is a start, as you say. There are going to be more protests on Friday. Will the protests continue after that? Do you think they should continue?
They should continue. We should put pressure because it worked. So we should carry on. I mean, this is from a personal view, but I interact with people every single day. People are saying, we used to protest every Friday. Now we're going to protest every day. This is what they said yesterday. Mm. We're not backing down until you're all gone.
Farah Swames, a filmmaker in Algiers, where President Abdelaziz Bouteflika has resigned. Farah, good to hear from you again. Thanks for sharing your thoughts today.
Thank you.
There is also a big turning point this week in the fight against climate change. For decades, oil and gas companies, ExxonMobil, for instance, dealt with the climate crisis by trying to hide what they knew about the science and by trying to confuse the public about the impacts of oil and gas on the global environment. Turning that on its head this week, Royal Dutch Shell, the company behind all the Shell gas stations, they announced they're quitting a major U.S. oil lobbying group. Mindy Luber is the CEO of the corporate sustainability organization Ceres. We're talking about a lobby called the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers. Why does it matter, Mindy, that Shell is leaving this organization?
Well, it matters because if a company steps up and says they're going to act on climate, and they're going to take steps to deal with getting their company in line with the Paris Agreement, they can't honestly at the same time be supporting trade associations who are trying to kill that agreement. It is simply not responsible or not honest. I mean, Shell agreed to three things a couple of months ago in a series of negotiations with investors, many of our members, and others. They agreed to set very clear and specific goals on how to bring their carbon footprint down, number one. Number two, they said they're going to hold their executives accountable, their top 1,000 executives, to meeting those climate goals. And number three, they're going to align their policy positions with that of their trade associations. And Shell gets, you know, they get a good deal of credit for being the first fossil fuel company to stand up and say, we are pulling out of one of the trade associations we're part of because they are advocating for the opposite of what we believe in on climate.
If this is about the goals of the Paris Agreement, it seems Shell's going to have to change a lot more than who does its bidding in Washington. How does this move fit into Shell's broader strategy to change what they do and how they do it?
Well, that's precisely what needs to happen. The fossil fuel industry is going to have to look substantially different. And so what the investors were saying to Shell in many, many of our discussions and meetings is you need to look at the future of this company. You need to set goals for, I would argue, radically reducing your emissions. And that may be starting to change your product mix. It may be that some of these oil and gas companies need to develop more of a renewables part of their business. It is the energy mix of the future. And if they're going to stay viable, they need to be moving in that direction. And what investors are asking them is to set very clear goals and implement them on how they're going to bring their carbon footprint down over the short term and over a longer term.
So a fresh start, it seems, but Royal Dutch Shell has wavered somewhat on turning toward a more sustainable business model over the years, and they have not left other big lobbying groups like the American Petroleum Institute. So how do you know that their recent new direction is really going to stick?
Look, we don't know. The investors that prevailed upon them to change their practices have made very clear they plan to follow up on a periodic basis. They expect to see what is happening every 6 months to a year. And there's no question Shell's got a lot more to do. They are at the start of their process, not at the end of it. We all know that to get to the Paris Agreement, it's about changing everything in what you do. Shell has to look at what the company might be and might look at 10 years from now and 20 years from now. That's more than a fossil fuel company.
I mean, just generally speaking, can any fossil fuel company really do what the science tells us needs to be done to quickly decarbonize our economy?
Look, it is not easy to ask a fossil fuel company to decarbonize overnight, but they cannot survive as a company in their present form and at the same time meet the Paris Agreement. The science says we need major decrease of fossil fuels, and the ExxonMobils and Shells and BPs have to look at transitioning their businesses, or frankly, the share value of their companies will not survive.
Shell is one of the biggest players in the global petroleum business, but it is only one. How much do you think the rest of the industry is going to follow their lead?
You know, there are certainly two or three other fossil fuel companies that are either following their lead or making their own commitments. A couple of them are probably in Europe, Total. BP is certainly trying to do more, but we've got ExxonMobil, who is doing anything but. So we still got a long way to go. I think it's important, more than symbolically, that Shell is setting goals. They're holding their executives accountable to meeting those goals. They're being transparent about it, and they're starting to pull out of lobbying organizations that, frankly, lobby for policies that will defy their goals. That's a good start, and we need to see the other fossil fuels follow suit.
Mindy Luber of the Corporate Sustainability Organization Ceres, thanks very much.
Great. Thank you.
Canada's Justin Trudeau is more than a prime minister. He's a brand, an earnest, good-looking, feminist charmer. But right now, that brand is taking a beating. Trudeau kicked two high-powered women out of his party yesterday, women who have been intensely critical of him. Here he is making the announcement.
Being a member of caucus comes with both rights and responsibilities. The team has to trust each other. And with Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott, that trust has been broken.
But it seems the trust that's been broken most is the trust in Justin Trudeau. The World's Andrea Crossan has been following the story. So take us back. What exactly happened here?
Marco, there are two women who are at the center of this story. One of them is a woman named Jody Wilson-Raybould. Raybould resigned weeks ago because she said that for months, Trudeau and people from his office had been pressuring her to interfere because she was the attorney general in a case that was an investigation about a construction company called SNC-Lavalin. The company had been charged with corruption and fraud, and she says that she was pressured by members of Trudeau's team to lower the charges against this company.
I resigned from cabinet because I did not have confidence to sit around the table, the cabinet table. That's why I resigned.
So she's the one woman at the center of the story. The other woman is a woman named Jane Philpott. She was the Treasury president, and she resigned in solidarity. Now, the two women were allowed to stay in the Liberal Party, but then on Friday...
So if he's thinking about bringing in somebody like Bev McLaughlin to give him advice,
Jody Wilson-Raybould released this secret recording that she took of one of Justin Trudeau's senior aides pressuring her.
I'm 100% confident I'm doing nothing inappropriate.
And it's been incredibly damaging to the Prime Minister.
No, but would not be if you decided to...
Justin Trudeau's response to it is kind of shocking. He didn't apologize. He kicked her and this other woman, Jane Philpott, out of the Liberal Party. So to get a sense of what that means, Marco, it would be like President Trump kicking Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham out of the Republican Party.
Yeah, this is massive.
It is. And considering that there's an election in the fall in Canada, this is a huge issue.
And Andy, what is all this doing to Trudeau's image, brand Trudeau?
He is a brand. I mean, a friend of mine bought me a pin with Justin Trudeau's face on it, which
I'm looking at it now.
Yes, I'm wearing it today, actually, just for you. But yeah, he's been really, really celebrated as this person who supported women. And there was this really iconic moment in 2015 after he was just elected and he introduced his cabinet, which had a balance of equal men and women on the cabinet. And here's a reporter calling out a question to him that day.
I understand one of the priorities for you was to have a cabinet that was gender balanced. Why was that so important to you?
Because it's 2015.
Andy, I remember us all looking at that news conference. What was it like for you watching that moment?
Well, to take my journalist hat off for just a second and just be a Canadian woman, it was amazing. It was a really powerful moment. And that really spoke to me. I thought, this is a change. This is a huge change in the way that women are being treated and empowered in Canada. And to go from that point where you run on a feminist agenda, then you kick out two strong women from your cabinet, it becomes a moment of feminist reckoning. And you see it today. I mean, there was a moment that if you believe in karma, Marco, this is a karmic kick in the butt. Prime Minister Trudeau was scheduled to speak to a group of young women called Daughters of the Vote for a conference on political empowerment for women. The Prime Minister addressed the group and they all stood up and turned their backs to him today.
Oh, sting.
Yeah, and it wasn't the only awkward moment. He was also accosted by a reporter during a scrum today.
What do you say to the women who are here for? What do you say to the young women who are here for Daughters of the Vote that might be discouraged that you just kicked two strong women out of your caucus?
I look forward to not just speaking to those young women who are here for Daughters of the Vote, but listening to them. I know there's going to be an opportunity to make some questions.
Okay, sounds like he's in trouble.
He's in trouble on a lot of levels. Right now, one of the other key issues that he's facing is that Jody Wilson-Raybould, one of the women that he kicked out of the caucus, is not just a powerful woman, she's also Indigenous. So for a man who ran on a platform of feminism and also improving the relationship between the government and Indigenous Canadians, as one Indigenous Canadian leader said today, he's toast.
How do you say dumpster fire in Canada? The world's Andrea Crossan. The vaquita is the rarest of marine mammals, a tiny species of porpoise on the brink of extinction, found only in the Gulf of California off the coast of northern Mexico. And thanks to reporter Clayton Kahn and our partners at the BBC, we're about to meet a Mexican scientist who's been working for 20 years to save the vaquita.
Beautiful animal. It looks like the panda. It has black patches around the eyes and lips. And it's dark gray on the dorsal part, and then it kind of fades into light gray and white.
That is the Mexican marine biologist Lorenzo Rojas Bracho. He's describing one of the smallest and rarest marine mammals in the world, known as the vaquita marina, which means little sea cow in Spanish.
Other fishermen told me they also called them an elf. Another name was ghost.
Originally, Lorenzo wanted to study the world's largest sea mammals, humpbacks and blue whales. But when a colleague beat him to research funding, Lorenzo shifted his attention to one of the smallest of all porpoises, the vaquita.
When we started, everybody said, vaquita's already extinct. A friend told me, Lorenzo, you shouldn't get into vaquita. This is going to burn you. It's a very difficult situation. He told me, Lorenzo, you don't want to be Mr. Vaquita.
Yet for better or for worse, Lorenzo would become Mr. Vaquita.
Nobody knew really what vaquita was, and so we started trying to make the world know about vaquita.
To educate the world about vaquita, Lorenzo first needed an accurate census of the population. In fact, he needed to actually see a vaquita alive. So in 1997, he organized a team, hired a boat, and launched an expedition in the upper sea of Cortez. After more than a week at sea, on the last day of the expedition, Lorenzo finally spotted the panda-like porpoise.
And it was so exciting to see finally this animal that I've seen the animal dead. I have worked with the DNA, I had photographs, but it was the first time I really saw the vaquita come out of the water, and I still have it in my brain. So beautiful, and the little face coming out of the water, and then cried a little with watching it after so many attempts to see it. I mean, it was like, wow, there it is. But it was fantastic.
Confirming that the vaquita was in fact alive and not a mystical ghost or elf, Lorenzo and his team placed a system of underwater microphones. The hydrophones record the clicks and high-frequency sounds the vaquitas make, enabling Lorenzo to determine the population size, which in 1997 was around 600 animals. Lorenzo would also take these recordings to talks and classes to educate the public.
The question was, how does vaquita sound? And it sounds like a fart. It's like...
Wait, how does it sound again?
So it's like... And I could see the students, they didn't want to laugh, but I could see them. And I told them, it's okay, just laugh.
This is the actual sound of the vaquita. After years of monitoring these animals, Lorenzo realized a horrifying trend. The animal was dying off at an alarming rate.
And we knew all the time since then that there was illegal fishing for totoaba.
Totoaba is a type of endangered sea bass, and its swim bladder has become a high-ticket commodity in Chinese cuisine. Illegal poachers use gill nets to fish the totoaba, but these nets also catch the vaquita accidentally, and it's been devastating for the porpoise's population. In 2012, things got out of control. That year, Lorenzo's census of the vaquita counted only 30 animals left on the planet.
There was so much money. And then, yeah, the sad part was I was threatened.
The Mexican-Navian police were deployed to prohibit poachers from casting any nets into the water. But this provoked the ire of criminals, and Lorenzo became a target.
So the first time I had a call, they said, are you Professor Rojas? And I said, yes. Well, you know, I'm calling you from Sinaloa cartel.
The Sinaloa cartel is one of the most infamous and brutal drug cartels in Mexico. And they've been linked with totoaba poaching.
And I hung up. And I didn't think it was a threat at that point in time.
But then...
Last year, I was in a meeting and a friend came to me and said, Lorenzo, there's a video.
In the video, criminals threatened to beat Lorenzo to a pulp if he were to return to the area, San Felipe, where he studies the vaquita. And these weren't empty threats.
In the area where we work, a soldier was killed. The head of the police in San Felipe was shot.
However, for Lorenzo and his team, despite the danger, the urgency to save the animal from extinction was at its highest.
Some of us started discussing, Jesus, we should start considering seriously catching vaquitas and put them under human care.
The plan was to use various boats, spotters, and U.S. Navy-trained dolphins to find, identify, and corral vaquitas into an ocean pen, where they would be held in captivity. It was a desperate move to save the animal. No one had ever tried to capture a vaquita before. On November 4th, 2017, the team managed to successfully capture one.
This is the animal we've been working so long. It's the first time I have it half a meter from me, just and watching every part of the animal, the eyes, the teeth, the snout. And so they took it to the sea pens, and everything looked like it was perfect.
Lorenzo told the environment minister the good news.
And I called the minister and told him, we have one. It looks like we're doing okay. Then I hung up, turned around, and everything had changed completely.
The vaquita they had captured began to swim erratically, stopped breathing, and the veterinarians in charge released it back into the ocean. The animal was not responding, and they began performing CPR that lasted hours. They were unable to save the animal.
Finally, Cynthia Smith, who was the co-director of the program with me, and she turned and looked at me and said, Lorenzo, sorry. And we cried like hell. I mean, just embracing Cynthia. Cried and cried and cried. It was horrible.
The program was called off as it seemed that vaquitas don't cope well in human care, and Lorenzo decided to focus efforts on upping the surveillance of poachers. But by this time, this dramatic attempt to save the species had made headlines around the world.
A endangered marine mammal, a small porpoise called the vaquita.
President Enrique Peña Nieto and Dr. Leonardo
DiCaprio. The most endangered marine animals.
And the media spotlight on the plight of this once unknown creature, dubbed the little sea cow, has shown the importance of conservation. The vaquita is in extremely dire straits, but Lorenzo says being optimistic is the only outlook he can adopt. He says as long as his hydrophones continue to record the fart-like clicks of the animal, there is still hope for the species.
A man putting his life on the line for an endangered porpoise. The BBC's Clayton Kahn reporting there from Mexico. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.